We've read histories, heard stories, and seen documentaries about war, about military conflicts, about soldiers. Veterans Day honors and celebrates the service of all United States military veterans, and in the next hour, you'll hear poetry and prose from local and area writers, veterans sharing their experiences as members of the U.S. Armed Services. This is Veterans Reflections. I'm Hans Ahlstrom. Something in the way. Something in the way. Yeah. Something in the way. Robin Romero served in the U.S. military over 24 years, from August 1982 to September 2006. He was a staff sergeant and served as a combat medic. His tours included the Gulf War, Iraqi Freedom, Bosnia with I-4, and a Cold War tour of Germany.
My service family tree. My father told me about the time he was 17 years old and sitting in the movie house in his hometown, Douglas, Arizona, on a December Sunday afternoon watching the matinee. The movie was suddenly halted. The lights came on and the theater manager came onto the stage with an announcement. He told the audience that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. The same type of scene was being played out across the entire United States. The country was at war. It was to affect the lives of millions of Americans, like my father. My father had admitted that many people, including him, had no knowledge of where Pearl Harbor was, but they listened to FDR on the radio and of the attack that would live in infamy, and he knew he had to do his duty. He wanted to become a Marine. Being only 17, he needed permission to join. His father provided him with a simple handwritten letter on plain stationery that said, "I am giving my son permission to enlist in the U.S. Marine Corps." He signed it with his full name. A short time later, my father got off a bus at Camp Pendleton, California, and went straight to boot camp. Some months after that, he was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division, destined for Guadalcanal in the South Pacific. The Marines' historic battle for Guadalcanal is a story that will be told and retold, since it is not likely to be forgotten, nor should it be forgotten. My father played a part in that history. When I was still very young and not mentally mature enough to understand war, it was like a game or some big adventure to me, as I'm sure other kids who played with toy guns must have thought. I knew my dad was a Marine, and he was very proud of that. I had heard names like Guadalcanal, New Zealand, and Australia spoken of, and remembered thinking how odd they sounded. The thing that fascinated me the most were the souvenirs my dad had from the war. My father had a small metal can with a hinged lid and metal clasp that sealed it rather tightly. I remember that if you were not careful, it could really pinch your fingers when opening it. It was an ammunition can. It had raised letters that said Cal, 30 mi ammunition box, stamped right onto the metal on the side. The contents of the can, when I was young, were very cool, almost magical. When I matured, the same contents had become like sacred objects from a holy shrine, after I had come to fully understand the meaning of what they were. Some of the contents, the souvenirs, are these. The letter my father carried to the induction center to enlist. When he enlisted, he gave them the name Henry. His real name was Enrique, the Spanish equivalent, because he was warned of racial bias in the military. One of the first things to shape the rest of his life, as Henry was his legal name thereafter. There were many others who enlisted to fight for America that was not allowed to share in all of the freedoms of being American. The military was still segregated then. They fought and made sacrifices and were heroes just the same. There were some insignias from Japanese uniforms and a small Japanese flag in the box. Their former owners no longer needed them. There was a small coupon-like item about the size of an ID card, adorned in elaborate blue ink scrollwork. It had 25 cents printed on it, and it stated that it was good for trade at the PX. It was known as military scrip. It was used in place of currency to cut down on illegal use of U.S. currency. Also in the box was a Purple Heart, the medal given to troops wounded in action in wartime. My father's part in the battle was to only last about a month. Enemy mortar fire caused shrapnel to penetrate him from his calves to his upper back. He was evacuated first to New Zealand, and then a stop in Australia, then back to the States via the territory of Hawaii. There were a number of coins in the box from those places, and there were some Japanese coins. Many years later, I learned that some of the coins I believed to be Japanese were in fact Chinese. The soldiers my father had faced had probably seen prior action. Another item in the box was an old black and white photo of my father's platoon. The photo was fairly well preserved, save for some discoloration and mildew caused by the tropical heat. The faces of the young Marines were darkened by the sun, and the light tan khaki uniforms they wore, with ties, made them appear very dark. There were around 80 of them in the photo. My father had put a light X over the faces of the Marines killed in action, and a circle around the ones wounded in action. There were none without a mark, and only 4 were circled, including the circle my father placed around himself. My father also had souvenirs from the war that didn't fit into his box. One was the disease malaria. Another was a fungus infection of the feet called jungle rot. Neither had a cure. They took their toll on my father's health. Later in life, when he was afflicted by diabetes and amputations of both legs became necessary, I took leave from the army, of which I had enlisted years earlier, to visit him in the hospital. While there, he joked that they finally cured his jungle rot. The surgeon who performed the operation was in the hospital room and commented that he was finding shrapnel during the procedure. The last item that didn't fit into the box was a K-bar knife, the Marine knife, my father's knife. He had once told me that there was human blood soaked into the leather handle that came from the hand-to-hand fighting that took place between the Marines and Japanese troops. He would add that he was pretty sure he stabbed at least 9 humans with the knife, and he was not sure they were all Japanese. This troubled him deeply, and I only remember him saying it once. But it spoke volumes of the ferocity of that fight. My older brother, my father's oldest son from a previous marriage, also joined the Marines. It was 1968, and he was 19 when he and our cousin enlisted. The current conflict was Vietnam. He and our cousin were the same age, and closer than I was to him, as I was only 11 years of age. They found themselves in Vietnam about the time of some of the heaviest fighting between the opposing forces there. They returned home in 1969, my cousin earning the Bronze Star. I never saw my brother alive again after the war. I was told later by other family members that the war affected him deeply. He was troubled by what he saw there. He and a friend had decided to find America. I could put in a footnote saying, see the 1960s, to explain that idea. He and his friend were going to travel eastward and eventually visit us in Wisconsin. Somewhere in the desert near the California-Arizona state line, they were both killed trying to hop a freight train. My family traveled from the Midwest to Los Angeles for the funeral. It was surreal at the funeral home. His badly bloated body was squeezed into his Marine dress blues and hardly resembled him. He was laid to rest, not getting much of a chance to see the country he fought for. There was no box of souvenirs for him, just a Marine yearbook with his boot camp photo and some old black and white photos of him when he was younger, left to remember him by. As I mentioned earlier, I had joined the Army. Both my father and cousin, who had been Marines, asked me, why the Army? I could only say that the Army was the branch that offered me the job I wanted. I ended up serving for just over 24 years. I served in the first Gulf War. I went to Bosnia with IFOR and was among the first U.S. troops to arrive there. 2 tours of Germany, one during the Cold War and one post-Cold War. My father died a week after troops started being shipped to the Middle East. He knew I was going to get my chance to go to war. I knew it bothered him to see young troops going in harm's way. I watched him eat dinner in front of the TV and CBS Evening News, watching the events of the war in Vietnam, concerned about his oldest son. It was appropriately called the TV War. He had already seen one son go off, and he never saw him alive again either. But he knew I had a duty to do. I would also return to Iraq for the third rotation of Iraqi Freedom. I guess somebody thought we had some unfinished business there, because back I went. I have quite a few souvenirs, too many to list. I show them to my friends and family. Maybe someday I can show them to my children or great-grandchildren. My youngest brother also served. He started out as an Army infantryman and later entered the active Air Force. His travels brought him around the globe. He served with distinction and retired after 27 years of service. He makes his home in the Philippines, and we keep in touch via the Internet. Just a couple of old vets talking about our past service and old campaigns. I had never thought about the notion of a service family tree until my oldest daughter came home and announced that she had enlisted in the Army National Guard. She was 18 and had finished high school and needed no permission. Until then, serving to me had just been something that you did. I had never thought of my children serving, and it was a surprise to me when she joined up. I had realized now how my father must have felt, and his father before him, to see children join up. I had always secretly worried that my two children, both daughters, would resent me as my military career separated us for long periods of time. I worried that they would see me as a negligent, absentee father. My worry was for naught. With no idea that my oldest was even considering it, I was stunned and proud of her, and for the first time, the idea of our service family tree came to light. My daughter also served. In fact, she outdid all of us in many ways. She won the Soldier of the Year competition for the state of Michigan. She was the first in the family to become a commissioned officer. She met her husband through the military and both served with distinction while having four children, a son and three daughters. Neither had to know the ordeal of war, and I am grateful for that. I know by the strength of character that each possesses, they would have served well if they had. I now have six grandchildren. I pray that none must ever know war. But I know, if any of them ever serve, they come from a line of service and a heritage of duty to the United States in uniform to be proud of. Gas masks. My father was a United States Marine. He was assigned to one of the most storied units in one of the most desperate fights in Marine history. I only had to mention that my dad was in the 2nd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, on Guadalcanal, to the old vets down at the Marine Corps League, and I would get a solemn nod and the comment, "There was a fight." One thing a U.S. Marine knows is Marine history. My father died in August of 1991, 1 week after U.S. troops started landing in Saudi Arabia, as the Gulf War was beginning. It bothered my dad to see young troops getting shipped off to war. His oldest son was a Marine in Vietnam. I was in the Army and it was going to be my turn to go to war. I went off to war. I returned. Another one for the history books. A book came out entitled Guadalcanal, written by Richard B. Frank in 1992. It was the first book I'd read on that battle. On the cover were reviews that lauded the book for its accuracy. I got a copy. I was curious about my dad's war now that I've seen one. Soon after reading the first few chapters, I came upon a passage that propelled me back more than 25 years to when I was 11 years old. I happened on one of my old neighbors. He was cleaning out his garage and piling up the junk on the curb, treasure to an 11-year-old. I came across an old gas mask and asked him, "Can I have this?" He said, "Sure," and I raced home with my trophy. When I got home, my dad was raking the yard. "Look what I got," I shouted triumphantly. My dad looked up and said, "That's the kind of gas mask they used in World War I. I asked, "Did you have gas masks?" He said, "Yeah, but we threw them away." He was using his "don't bother me, I'm busy" voice, so I didn't press him further. That moment had faded from my memory until I read a passage in the book. The Marines' incursions inland were marked by discarded gas masks. Suddenly I felt a surge of emotion with the realization that my dad had already told me this so many years ago. The Last Man Out. On the top shelf sits a bottle, down at the Legion post. from a pact made by comrades, a promise made, brothers by a war. A tradition used by others, and so the story goes, until only one is left, just one last soldier standing, of those who made the pledge, to return and toast the others, if the last man out he be. Now the bottle sits unopened, a silent tribute placed above the bar. On that day when a single brother stood, though he has watched his friends depart, to open the bottle now, he simply had not the heart.
Robin Romero reading his story My Service Family Tree, a vignette entitled Gas Masks, and the poem The Last Man Out. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90, WNMU, and at WNMUFM.org. Michael Greer was a Sergeant E5 in the U.S. Army 2nd Battalion, 59th. He served from September 1969 to August 1971.
Top of the hour tonight, 1900 hours or 7 p.m., and time for some news from WFTA-FM, your local GI station. Tonight's top story, GI stabbed in bar fight, reported by Die Zeit last night at the Twilight Cafe on Karl-Benz-Strasse in Mannheim. Spec 4 Jeremy Reed was stabbed in the chest by a large German male and assaulted by another bar customer when the fight they were having turned in the GI's favor. Spec 4 Reed is in satisfactory condition at the Mannheim Army Hospital and expecting a full recovery. The two Germans were arrested by local police, with MPs clearing out the rest of some 20 other GIs in the bar. Spec 4 Reed was attacked after offering to buy a round of drinks for some German girls at another table. No American arrests were made. In the spring of 1970, in downtown München, Munich, Germany, we heard about another incident months before in the German newspaper Die Zeit, something our group often bought out in the economy, the term we used when we went out in public, dressed as civilians. The story wasn't covered in the Stars and Stripes, official U.S. Army newspaper. While other soldiers were going to local bars in groups of 10 and getting in fights over local women with local men, our group, 10 of us, gathered after work each day at the home of our only married couple, off campus, as we called it. We would gather to drink some wine, eat some cheese and breads, occasionally smoke some hashish every night, and discuss the night before's events. We then would pair up and travel overnight to new European cities, towns, and villages, some famous, some obscure, for some sightseeing. The hour from 5 p.m., when we got out of work, to 6 p.m., was spent telling of our travels the night before, each pair giving the group an idea of how much there was to see and do in these other places of interest. The trains were our friends, as we could travel to Italy or France overnight, or to the Netherlands for a long weekend. It was great fun for all of us. Our friend's wife, the only female in the group, traveled with her Spec 5 husband. He was an amazing photographer and filmmaker, so his presentations were always attention grabbers. The rest of us had trouble recalling most of our adventures, simply because so much would happen in such a short time. We would travel each night with a different member, as we all enjoyed each other's company. We explored points of interest in all these locales. Could be an ancient bridge or a statue, or an exquisite church or cathedral, sometimes a museum, or just the countryside in a farming village. Got to see more of Europe than the average GI, see how people lived in each location. This went on for a few months until we read the story in Die Zeit. It was about a black soldier who had been beaten to death by several German cab drivers, just because one of their own had been assaulted by a pair of blacks soldiers in Kitzingen, miles away from our Nuremberg. He'd been selected at a train station, led on a wild goose chase until about 20 cabbies could gather in a particular dark alley. This could have been any one of us, our group being half black. We felt we were not getting the local and national news like we should, so we took matters into our own hands. We knew of several on-base incidents that had been overlooked by the Army paper, some making it into Die Zeit. The biggest to us so far was the three of our battalion GIs killed in a deadline armored personnel carrier, APC. All three having less than 3 weeks left in their Army careers. All three were married, two with kids. Our battalion commander, Colonel Ryan, assigned these men the task of driving this deadline vehicle, meaning it needed repairs, even though it was against Army regs and German law to drive such a vehicle on civilian roads. One of the tracks came off the vehicle as it was crossing a bridge. Another law broken. No tracked vehicles on bridges. It turned 90 degrees and fell 20 feet to the dried-up riverbed below. All three soldiers were killed instantly. I had to help retrieve their bodies. Their heads were swollen the size of basketballs. With the colonel to blame, the story was never covered in either Die Zeit or Stars and Stripes, not even when our battalion personnel gathered in front of the colonel's brick home that night and threw Molotov cocktails at his house. It was this lack of immediate news that led our group to our next steps. We decided to create an FM radio station, illegally, of course, for broadcasting news to our fellow soldiers. It would be brief, on the hour, and completely hush-hush. We got the radios and parts from the battalion repair shop, and its hundreds of partial radios laying around. We even found it simple to steal a deadlined Jeep ambulance to haul the parts around, eventually building the station inside this vehicle, a windowless panel truck. We examined the skills and assets of each of us. We had men who could drive trucks on the German roads, an important factor. Our married friend was a supply sergeant. Two of us were radio repairmen. Three more were radio operators. One a radio teletype operator with civilian DJ experience. That was me. I had worked as a DJ in high school and again in college for each school's radio station. So I was selected to be the first DJ for WFTA-FM. The two radio repairmen worked together at battalion and had access not only to new parts, but the deadline scrapped equipment as well. Our humble station would broadcast in English, and instead of Radio Free Europe, it would be called WFTA-FM or Radio Free the Army. Only the F wasn't for the word free. The F word replacement was started by one of our listeners, and we went with it. We generally kept it clean on the air, following all the strict rules of the ASA and FCC. In our spare time, we fixed the ambulance at the Army scrapyard. One of our members was a mechanic there. He confidently traded engines with different vehicles, tires, brakes, etc. We even painted a bogus bumper designation on the truck, HQ7, 2/59, which in reality was the name of our headquarters company Jeep. In this ambulance, we spirited away enough radio parts to build not one, but two FM transmitters, with a pair of FM receivers, plus one for our married couple's home, our new headquarters. We hooked it all up just like my teletype rig was arranged, a vehicle with top-secret clearance. We were broadcast at the top of every hour from 6 till midnight. The broadcast would last only as long as our news stories, plus a 5 to 10 minute segment about our travelogues to other countries, different points of interest. We became very popular with fellow GIs, and we were harmless at first. As the weeks went on, we were getting more and more stories about troubles GIs faced out in the economy, the good and the bad. We had stories of GI rape of local girls, of GIs beatings suffered at the hands of local men, attacks on single soldiers walking city streets, and we counted on Stars and Stripes for their stories that we could investigate further on our own, interviewing the principals, getting the real stories. Even their Vietnam stories were far from accurate, as soldiers had arrived in Germany after serving in Nam to fill us in on the truth. Suddenly, we were filling most of an hour, still continuing our travel segments, becoming a nuisance to the Army. They weren't happy with some of our work, as some of our stories hit newspapers back home. Four of us read and spoke German fairly fluently. Zwei Bratwurst mit Brötchen und mit Fehlen Senf, bitte. This was our standing order from street vendors everywhere in Germany and Austria. For 2 marks, 50 cents back then, one could get 2 bratwurst on a split hard roll with German mustard similar to Grey Poupon. 2 sandwiches for a buck was a fine meal. Vendors served them from 50-gallon drums cut in half for a charcoal stove with wheels for easy transport. Our job was to translate stories from Die Zeit and other German news sources into English for our GI public. The others were writing travelogues about our two-man trips, which we continued to throw off any suspicion, with one rotating two-man group doing the station work each night. Our broadcasts were complete with what was important to the GI traveling, i.e., the availability of girls, booze, hashish, the best ways to travel, don't take the 7 p.m. train, it's always overcrowded, what museums were free, etc. Also, which cities, like Frankfurt, regularly cheated GIs by overcharging, and who did or didn't like us in their country. We also got a little preachy, trying to uplift the behavior of the average GI. Be a good example in other countries. All of us tried to make it back these trips by 8 a.m., roll call the next day. When someone was later missing, we found excuses to make to our officers, etc., including forged written excuses, hospital lab work, special assignments. Our favorite ploy was the runaround, i.e., he's over at the motor pool, just saw him, or I think he went on sick call, etc. Sharing these tricks was appreciated by our public as well. We got our feedback in the cafeteria, or after dinner, guys talking. It was gratifying, and it kept us both sharp and current to their needs. You want movie reviews? We'll go to the movies for you. U.S. sports news? We'll have to watch some TV, etc. Lots of local Germans were now listening to us, sometimes their only example of spoken English, allowing them to practice their new second language. We got away undetected for about 6 months. Then one day it happened. The Army assigned me to assist the ASA, Army equivalent of FCC, in tracking down this particularly troublesome rogue radio station, this WFTA. We had been noticed. We were already a mobile unit, just to stay out of harm's way off base. We would park somewhere obscure, broadcast the night away from that spot, then move the vehicle into a private garage at night that a German friend loaned us. I alerted my comrades that I have a new job and we would go into secret mode. We started driving the ambulance while broadcasting. This made it impossible to triangulate our signal with the 3 jeeps we had out looking for them, or us. If they, or we, we're getting close. I would make some excuse to use a civilian phone. Have to call my girlfriend in Kitzingen, etc. No cell phones in the 70s. I would call our German friend, the one with the garage, and relay important information. And he would transmit to the ambulance that the triangulators were getting close, etc. Triangulation is where each of 3 Jeep radios locate the source of a signal direction. Then on a map, where the 3 lines create, crisscross, and intersect, that would be the source of the broadcast. The ASA was getting very serious about this. I advised our group to lay low for longer periods. Now even the local papers, whose stories we were borrowing, were reporting about us in the news. We started broadcasting that we would close down for 3 days, but be back up the next day. 5 days, back in two. A public figured this out, but my ASA team took longer to catch on. Soon, there were two teams of three Jeeps triangulating, then three teams. They could not figure out how we kept moving around. At one point, they thought we were several separate stations broadcasting. A conspiracy. Maybe we should alert the CIA. There were several close calls as our ambulance drove past an ASA Jeep. Keeping the ambulance a military vehicle proved to be our best way to blend in. There were so many others on German streets. One day we were stopped while I was driving. MPs pulled us over, and I had to react quickly with a story about a deuce-and-a-half accident 6 clicks away. They tried to escort us, but we ditched them on a road that was well-known shortcut. No suspicion. By September of 1971, we were operating about 10 months, but I was going home, discharged. I had applied for a European out, meaning the Army would still pay my way home with all my household goods up to a year after discharge. I was sure I wasn't going home after a year. Unfortunately, General Westmoreland had decided to cut back the troops stationed in Germany by 50,000, sending me and others home 2 months early. This meant I had to go home to discharge. I couldn't stay in my rented house in Salzburg, Austria, where I was a grandfather clock restorer in Munich, and live with my Texas-German Army brat girlfriend and drive her MGB and my BMW 900 motorcycle. Ah, the best-laid plans. Two others in the group were discharged with me, with four of them a month later. The old gang was breaking up. The last of the original 10 parked the ambulance in the garage and left, too. It was great to hear, about a year later, the ambulance was up and running again. New GIs decided to run a risk. But unfortunately, it was discovered parked on a side street in Nuremberg and confiscated. No one was caught using it. ASA case finally closed. The good part is this new group of soldiers learned their lessons well, believed in our cause to disseminate the news, the truth, and started over from scratch. A beat-up German catering truck. New broken radios fixed. New two-way walkie-talkies to avoid the triangulators, etc. We had no catchphrases like Kronauer did in Vietnam, but we served the same purpose, broadcasting the truth as best we could.
Michael Greer, reading his story, WFTA-FM. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU and at WNMUFM.org. Alex Gubbins served as sergeant in the U.S. Army Reserve from 2000 to 2008. He was deployed to the war in Iraq from 2004 to 2005, where he served as an Army enlisted counselor.
Dear brother, I visit you, plot 122, shallow and loosely packed. Rest my head there through sun and storm and scorpion. Mother will not come. Sister will not come. Father buries himself in prayer and rum. Today, a year later, Yassine stops over to share hummus and codeine, asks for anything new of the crime. I respond by watching my cigarette burn to filter, the pain in his face a comfort to me. You, brother, bring the breath of childhood, when an empty field was a place to play, when verse of thunder raised our spirits, when peanuts and cola were all we craved. We'd listen for the bread man's bell, run to mother together, the kitchen always bright and full of her hair, long and black and young, the kitchen, cardamom and cumin without the lamb. If pomegranates could talk, They'd speak of fingers, ours, brother, swollen and red over the bowl to catch falling seeds. The neighbor boy still drums on his step. The streetlight flickers bright green. Hurry up and wait. We spend Saturday nights together, but isolated in the same room. Dickerson reads the newspaper in a corner chair. DeLuna pumps 10-pound bells at the doorway. I play solitaire at the desk we liberated from a junkyard. Hip-hop beats take off the edge, 'cause we know rockets could find us anytime. Like Velasquez, hit drawing a supply route on a map, spread out on his Humvee hood. Or Petrie, who opened the door to spit out his chew, bam, a mortar. I play solitaire, it comforts me. I am my only opponent. I risk aces never showing, kings useless in my palms. When I come to the deck's end, I shuffle the cards until my sergeant yells, "Form up!" In the guard tower. Mortar landings flash on the night airfield in threes, the way votive candles flicker in a drafty cathedral. Hail Mary, Mother of Wind, don't blow our way. I count between flashes and strikes, like I would in thunderstorms when I camped as a child in spring. The downpour would come, clouds clear, then a million frogs would sing for the stars. Tonight, the moon's crescent bends like a crooked smile, lights the Apaches above us, thundering to the enemy's position. In this desert, some things are certain. The call to prayer 5 times a day, mortar attacks when we sleep, and bullets rain more than water drops from the clouds. Motion. His pruners fit more snug in his palm than the M16 he had for 8 years. At night, near County Q, when no cars drum the gravel and cows lie on hay, he trims branches. He'll nudge his blade into a cleft, snipping those already dead. It's better this way, he says. Sometimes the branch is too stubborn, and he'll cut harder, even if he knows it'll never give in. When leaves rustle, he stills. Maybe a squirrel flies in the upper branches, or the wind rushes the forest from the open pastures. It's not Haji, he says, it's not Haji. If it were, the safest spot's behind a tree or a rivet in the dirt. Without his gun, he'd use his pruners. He'd keep quiet, wait for the advance, lunge and snip in a single motion. Relief at FOB Spiker, December 26th, 2004. Like 9/11, the news stops everything, and we gather around the unit's only TV to watch a reporter point to a map, circle a blue place in the middle of nowhere, explain how a few waves are the cause for thousands of deaths. Private Andre sits straight up in his chair, grunts, then inhales a long breath. The commander pauses over a stack of pressing evaluations, pushes them aside as the news shows the water lifting a house higher than a telephone pole. Every muscle in my body relaxes as I sip a full cup of thick brown Java, steaming the scent of Columbia. The Wadi. When we came to Mosul, we learned about the Wadi. Units before us lost weapons and armor in the Wadi. We heard about a time wheels fell off a Humvee. The sergeant couldn't find them anywhere in the Wadi. an Iraqi soldier ghost, it was rumored, roamed in rocks, rivers, caves in the Wadi. He searched for enemies, some said, would steal their canteens, boots, bullets in the Wadi. Our matches went out, M16s jammed. Desire to kill disappeared when we passed through the Wadi. One time, we drove for miles to Baghdad, Basra, back to Mosul. We broke down in the Wadi. It was nighttime. The wind died. Wild dogs barked. Then we heard footsteps in the darkness of the Wadi.
Alex Gubbins reading his poems Dear Brother, Hurry Up and Wait, In the Guard Tower, Motion, Relief at FOB Spiker, December 26, 2004, and The Wadi. Gubbins is currently teaching English composition in the Foreign Language Department of the Community College of Qatar, Doha. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU and WNMUFM.org. So take a good look at my face. Oh, you'll see my smile. Yeah, look a little bit closer and see all the tracks of my Alan Lurst was an E-4 in the Army with the 101st Air Mobile in Vietnam from 1969 to 1971.
Hey, yeah. It's always about bodies. Lately, I was dreaming a lot about Vietnam, which crept its way back into my subconscious, showing me its vivid mutations of real events morphed into fantasy. The bones of the dead reached from the ground. The jungle crawled with insects. Maybe it had something to do with my age, that cycle of time that would eventually return me to an infantile state of childhood nightmares. It was a theory. When I thought I'd come to terms with Vietnam, sloughing it off like skin from a venomous snake, burying it as deep as I could in the recesses of memory, the war called, "Hey, Bonehead, I'm still here." It was always about bodies. A reconnaissance dog had unearthed a dead North Vietnamese soldier in red clay that ran like blood down the trail during monsoon and slick under our boots. I took an entrenching tool out of my rucksack and handed it to Tennessee, a good old boy from guess where, and he passed it to homeboy from Detroit. The NVA was at least a month dead. You can't help but be drawn to a thing like that. You can't help but look. Before they bagged him, I stared like everyone else. His skin was algae green, like pond scum. His eyes were gone. His vacant sockets showed a rim of bone. In the heat, his putrid flesh had an unimaginable odor. My first week in Vietnam, Sergeant Curtis said there was no smell worse than a rotting human. The stink of human death was a truth revealed to me in the failing light of the Central Highlands. When the shovel came back to me, I threw it into the shadow-lit jungle. The odor lingered in my nose as we humped up the ridge. It stayed there for 30 years. When I came back from Vietnam, my friend Chudy seemed to have it all, which is a story we learn about how to be good Americans. The requirements were a steady job people envied, a split level in Shiras Hills, a car for your wife, a pickup truck for you, plenty of toys, four-wheelers and snowmobiles, kids who survive childhood and graduate from college, all the possessions needed to make you believe you were living the American dream, that mythic story everyone wants to believe. So we went ice fishing, not knowing a plastic jug of gas would explode because Chudy forgot it was next to the kerosene he lit with a propane torch and set his ice shanty on fire. We were outside, but Chudy had opened the door just when gasoline fumes ignited and flames engulfed him. Without hesitation, I screamed, "Run, Chudy!" He ran from the fire, the sleeves of his leather coat burning. Flames turned the sky napalm orange, just like a ridge line in Vietnam's central highlands. Yellow light spread over the ice in a hellish inferno. I fell face first onto the ice and covered my head. I smelled burned clothing. Several NVA soldiers ran downhill away from the burning ridgeline into the bamboo and elephant grass. I sighted down my rifle and fired, but my gun jammed. Kenny Bonomo looked at me, his eyes asking why I wasn't firing at the NVA. Then Bonomo was on one knee to fire. "Stay down," I yelled. A bullet ripped through Bonomo's throat, and he slumped forward into the tall grass. When I got to him, he was lifeless. One eye stared at a leech in the grass next to his cheek. I could smell Nook Mom, a pungent Vietnamese fish sauce, sandalwood, and cinnamon incense. I could smell my girlfriend's letters I kept in a waterproof ammo can, which I often took out to breathe in her perfumed scent. That night, after I thought Chudy was safe in the Marquette General Hospital, I had the strangest dream. The missing fingers on my hand were again fresh wounds. I heard gunfire, explosions, Vietnamese voices. Blood poured from my hand. It wouldn't stop. I was in a cornfield. There was a barn. I ran inside. Sunlight poured through spaces between missing barnwood boards. Everything was in shades of gray, in a cross-hatched pattern. I climbed a ladder into an empty hayloft. Spiderwebs occupied every corner and crevasse, glistening silver threads as thick as baling twine. I placed my hand inside the webs. They were sticky, like cotton candy. Spiders with faces poked out of holes and then disappeared. The webs grew over my hand. The bleeding stopped. A North Vietnamese soldier laughed and pointed at the hayloft door. I walked to the edge of the opening. Outside, American and Vietnamese soldiers were on carnival rides, a tilt-a-whirl, a Ferris wheel, a roller coaster. The Ferris wheel turned into a Huey medevac helicopter. The chopper turned into a dragonfly that flew across summer fields. The next morning, Chudy was dead. Prisoner for Frank Fu Fujita. You will go to war. That's how time works. The Abilene reporter asks, "What's it like being drafted?" You say, "I'd rather draw cartoons." You are an artist. Your father is Japanese. Your mother's name is Pearl. She's from Texas. The Abilene reporter says he's a bright-eyed youth. He feels no desire to visit Japan. Just like that, you are a prisoner of war. You keep a diary full of cartoons. You resurrect time, days, months, years. The diary is not allowed. The soldiers watch you. You are not allowed enough food, and the Japanese soldiers beat you. They beat the Dutchman. He steals food, and they slam you, a baseball bat. Wham, wham, wham. You write in the diary and remind yourself, oh, how that did hurt. You stand upright. You are American. Stare into your captor's eyes. In there, somewhere, is a picture of a Japanese soldier, drunk. He laughs, sprawls on the floor. Soldiers pour boiling water down the Dutchman's throat. You keep your voice hidden in the diary. Suma suma, one guard says. His skin is like yours. You are one of them. You are just like me. You eat rice from bowls alive with maggots. Your comrade's bowels twist. By morning he is dead. You survive. Your flesh falls away. You feed on yourself. You draw pictures in the benjo. This is not allowed. The Japanese put up a sign. You will be killing to death. But the maggots join you. Blackbirds come to eat them. You eat the birds. You are part of the lost battalion. Your uniform hangs in a closet. What connects any of us to ourselves? Centipede. Kill a centipede with your machete. Watch it squirm into a pile of sticks. Poke and prod it with your M16. Give up old bones and insects in pieces beneath your boots. The ground is a tangle of roots. Under the dead's disturbed soil. Slice the centipede into pieces. Let it dance on a pin. Combat pay is acid on your tongue. Kill the centipede with your machete. Watch it bleed. Talk to me, so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
Alan Lurst, reading his story, It's Always About Bodies, an excerpt from an unpublished novel called Bonefish, and the poems Prisoner and Centipede. Right on. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90, WNMU, and WNMUFM.org.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our...
Milton Bates was a sergeant in the Army from 1970 to 1971 during the Vietnam War.
That stands the end. No safety or surprise, the end.
Payback. Sanders, the Sandman, was the shooter on our recon team. The guy we counted on to take a Victor Charlie's cares away with a single round, put him to sleep. He was methodical, businesslike. Punched in, did his job, punched out, no regrets. Which isn't to say he had no fantasies. Here's one he let us in on. Back in the world, he would stalk the members of his draft board one by one. He'd lay the crosshairs like a blessing on a face, a man's, let's say, taking out the trash, or a woman's starting up her car. Those months of practice, punching in and punching out, would do the rest. He'd inhale deeply, release a bit, then hold steady, his fingertips so wetted to the trigger that he couldn't tell before from after. Except there'd be no after, no bullet-smashing bone. Why kill, he reasoned, if the killing didn't matter, only the singling out for death? We jumped all over him, demanding, not even a note? What's the point if they'd never know? Because he'd let us in. Because the fantasy was ours, too. I would know, the Sandman said, nodding as though possessed of esoteric wisdom. I'd know I'd chosen them this time. Sure-footed. Carlos was a moralist, which is why the question made him stop and think. Are you sure-footed in rough terrain? Fact is, no one in our squad was surer walking point. He had the eyes, ears, and feet of a feral cat, alert for tripwires fine as spider filament, disturbed earth, a sniper's safety clicking off. The rest of him belonged to Western Civ, Boy Scouts, church on Sunday, the Disney flick Pinocchio. That's what nearly tripped him up, taking the Army aptitude test. because he was trying, he told us one day on patrol, not to show an aptitude for infantry. Pounding ground in Vietnam? Hell no. Bad enough I got drafted. Still, the question made him look around the room. All those shaved, anonymous heads bent over test forms. What if some computer, blind as fate, took him at his word? Groped the braille of graphite dots and sent another guy instead. It was rough terrain, but his pencil landed like a cat on no. Carlos grinned, hating the work, loving the irony. Don't mean nothing, he shrugged. Desk job can kill you too.
Surprise the end. I'll never look into your eyes again.
Milton Bates, reading his poems Payback and Sure-Footed.
Can you picture what will be so limitless and free? Desperately in need of some strange.
Our thanks to Michael Greer, Milton Bates, Robin Romero, Alan Lurst, and Alex Gubbins for sharing their work. Veterans Reflections is a production of Public Radio 90 WNMU. I'm Hans Ahlstrom.
Each night as I sleep.